Hello and welcome to the recording number 16 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. I'm going to restart here on page 115. Paragraph number 6. I would love it, she replied, but I have nothing to wear, and I feel so inferior because of it. A girl must look pretty, you know. Then Adaz gave him her most appealing glance, and Gord said that perhaps he'd have a gift for her when he picked her up in the morning. If it is a nice present, perhaps we won't have to return tomorrow night, she said in a sultry voice. That it would be a nice present, Gord was certain. Returning or not was a matter to be determined, by other than Adaz, except rather indirectly. She had better be prepared for quite a day, he mused. What Gord had in mind was allowing her to exercise her dubious talents as a pilferer, while remaining in the background, and using his own abilities. Thanks to the diversion she would provide, Gord should be able to have a field day. It was a cynical thing to do, but why not? He had become a rather cynical fellow, to say the least. Break. All right, well, here we have Adaz, she is trying to be coy with Gord to gain some kind of beautiful clothing, or perhaps the ruby earrings which she had Gord had purchased to save her from being caught as a thief. Now here, Gord refers to her dubious talents as a pilferer, and earlier he had referred to the guards of the goldsmith as stalwarts. Now, while those could easily be, part of the normal way of describing things, it's also part of the, AD and Z system at the beginning to have labeled different levels by different titles. So I could see where stalwart or pilferer would be kind of an indicator of what level or even kind of an NPC class. You could even have an NPC class of guardsman or guard that had different level titles. And in a sense, I kind of get the feeling that the use of those terms is being, Gord is, Gygax is using them, I think, to indicate something more than just a additional description or describer. I think it is something that is, a pilferer sounds like somebody who would be pretty low down in the abilities of a thief. And then we also have Gord commenting about being more cynical. And, finally, this could be Gord at least recognizing that he is naive in some matters. And up until very recently, still seeming, especially with his involvement with women, always involving some kind of naivete from, getting linked up with Estrella, Adaz now, Hylene, I think her name was, all showing that there's a certain naive to Gord, and that perhaps here he is maturing in some cynical way. All right, I am going to restart. It is page number 116 and paragraph 3. Plotting, Gord strolled off to where he had established his place near the family camp of Miklos. Bright and early the next morning, he went to where he told Adaz to meet him, and sure enough, she was there, smiling. He handed her the earrings. After being careful to keep her out of trouble during the morning, then plying her with wine in the early afternoon, Gord led his unsuspecting decoy into the area of the city where gem merchants had their shops. Although the wares displayed close to where a thief could attempt snatch-and-run tactics were of little value, their glow and glitter were quite spectacular. Adaz was quickly enmeshed in the place, becoming filled with a growing desire to possess some of the beautiful stones that the pair was ogling in the shop windows. He actually entered one place and peered intently at the aquamarines, pearls, topazes, and similar stones there. The place had nothing of really exceptional value, but their visit served to further whet the girl's appetite for such baubles. They exited the shop and moved on a few paces, and then Gord told her that he remembered a brief errand he must take care of. Adez should continue to enjoy herself by viewing the gemstones while Gord was gone for a bit. They could meet again at the end of the lane, only another few hundred feet up. In half an hour, Adez readily assented. After walking rapidly away and turning a nearby corner, Gord counted to 30, slowly, and then retraced his steps in a leisurely fashion. As he again rounded the corner, he saw Adez entering a fairly large shop halfway down the lane. He continued in her direction in his most leisurely manner, taking special care to remain unnoticed. From a vantage point across the street, he watched the Rene girl examining the contents of the gem merchant's establishment. It appeared to be a fairly prosperous shop, although not the one he had hoped she would choose. Well, never mind, he would make the best of it. Adez had been busy in the short time she'd been in the place, Ward noted as he strolled closer. There were quite a few different stones on the counter, and Adaz was pointing to her earrings and gesturing disdainfully at the loose gems. She was probably demanding to see larger rubies to match those on her ears. Gord turned partially away from the small glass panes of the shop window, pretending to watch the scattered traffic passing by, perhaps awaiting someone, but surveying the interior of the shop out of the corner of his eye. Another few minutes, Adaz thought she had created... After another few minutes, Adaz thought she had created a sufficiently confused situation and acted. While she was decrying the terrible quality of the stone she had been shown, the girl used her hidden left hand to take a large spindle. The offended merchant didn't notice immediately, for by then the two were exchanging rather vile insults. As she marched in mock outrage for the door, however, the man came to his senses and took an inventory with his eyes. Of course he noticed that the spindle was not there, and he voiced an angry shout. Adaz broke into a run and was outside the place as its owner vaulted over the counter, shouting at the top of his lungs. Because Gord stood to the right of the door, Adaz scooted left and away as fast as she could, not recognizing him in her haste to make good her theft and escape. Gord stayed planted as the shopkeeper came out and turned left in hot pursuit. It reminded him of his old days in the slum quarter, and he chuckled softly to himself. Then he stepped into the shop, drew his dagger, and vaulted the counter. A large, brawny youth, probably the owner's son or apprentice, was just coming through the curtain as Gord landed. The sound of Gord's pommel striking the unsuspecting fellow's head had a hollow sound, and the blow felled him like a steer at slaughter. Empty head or not, it would be sore for the next few days, thought Gord. But he's alive. There was no time to fret about that anyway. Every second counted. As Gord had assumed he would do, the man had taken time to scoop all of his precious merchandise into an iron strongbox and lock it. He had the key with him, of course. The sounds from the lane nearby were growing louder and more frenetic. All was well still, but he would have to hurry. Gord took his weapon and thrust it against the hard metal of the lock. The point bit as if it were going into soft wood rather than cold iron. After a rapid succession of several such cuts, the lock was useless and the box open. Without bothering to select the better ones, Gord took as many stones as he could stuff into his shirt in a few seconds. Then he recrossed the counter and walked calmly out of the shop, heading away from the brawl going on a few doors down. It seemed that some fishmonger passing this way on his journey home had run squarely into the gem merchant. The outrage of the latter at losing the thief who had robbed him was matched by that of the fishmonger, who was demanding to know who would pay for his spilt catch. Passers-by took sides, and a near riot was now in full swing. Shutters were being slammed and locked, doors barred, calls for the patrol were passing down the streets round about. Gord was gone from the turmoil in less than a minute. Great. All right, that was a bit of a long read there, but as it's covering action, it gives you an idea of what could be an encounter, but at the same time isn't really rich in too much setting material. We have a little smidgen at the beginning about Muddock, or the name of the little village near Radagast City, and where the Miklos and the Rene have set up a little encampment, or a description of their barges hooked together there. And then we have, yep, there it is on one of the maps. There we, have this, it still seems strange to me that they would be encamped or tied up at a small town, up the Artansame from Radagast City, rather than going to Radagast City itself. There's a reason, but it's never explained. I would have liked having Gygax just make a brief mention of why that would be, because it just stands out to me as a little strange. We have a little bit more about Radagast City. That is actually quite a long street of gem merchants that Gord is talking about. We also learn that the merchant is there calling for the patrol. So there's like Greyhawk, there is an internal patrol of the city. It is interesting, I think, to look at the reaction. It seems a little strange that the one gem merchant has guards and that this one does not, and also that he would take his time to lock up the gems in the empty shop when he had his son in the back room, and allowing Adez, able to run off. It just seems like there should be something a little more secure in place. And if I was running a scenario, and I think this is a good idea for what you can do, with any city, is have some kind of snatch and grab thieving thing for either the characters to be involved in, or for them to be walking into the midst of all this, or even getting entangled in the brawl that starts when the merchant runs into the fishmonger. So it's an interesting idea. I would set it up a little more, a little differently myself, because it seems like that any of these people should be prepared for that kind of thievery, with distractions and snatching grabs, and that it shouldn't be as easy for someone to come in, and that the place wouldn't have a door guard. I it is how the scenario is written. It just seems a little odd to me. We get a picture, of how they would do such a thieving, but I think it's still not much more information about the setting or information here about the Gord, although it does show Gord's changing attitudes. It doesn't say what would happen if Adaz had been caught again, so he kind of avoids that, and I don't know that Gord is suddenly so cynical that he's going to set her up and what kind of punishment she might be in for as a thief. And, you know, as they had mentioned in the City of Greyhawk, that could be, a workhouse or having her hand cut off. It could be a very terrible thing for Adaz. And so it just seems a little harsh at this point, even if Gord is getting cynical, to bring that down on Adaz, you know. So and really not having done anything terrible to Gord. So I do find that little bit somewhat out of character for the Gord character.
Yeah, he totally sets her up.
Yeah, and the punishments could be so harsh that, it's not just some light thing. It's with this setting, the way that Greyhawk is, if we take a look at that, I mean, it could be her life. And, it's all a very, there's things that they could have had Gord do. It seems like it's a very, kind of simplistic setup for that robbery. And with very harsh consequences. So I don't see how the Gord character had reached this point so suddenly that on the one hand, he spends, two gold to rescue Adaz, and then in the next uses has her like a stalking horse so that he can rob, and whatever happens to her happens to her. And there's so many ways they could have set it up where they could have had Gord or some other Rene as like the fishmonger or as a merchant or somebody to run into the escaping merchant. There could have been some kind of regular plan. And he's just counting on her being, and he gets her drunk too. It mentions how, takes her out in the morning and gets, has her drinking and stuff. It just doesn't seem to be the character of Gord as he's been established. And whether he's getting cynical or not, that seems very harsh.
Yeah, I think he's getting a little fed up with them. But, I don't think he would have let her go to jail. Or at least he would have tried to help.
Yeah, I don't see that. It seems out of character.
Sure.
All right. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 118, paragraph 3. Went to a tavern and enjoyed himself there. Then Gord headed for the down quarter of Radagast City, an area where few questions were asked. The previous day, he'd seen a place there he thought would be perfect for his purpose. When his recognition signal was returned, Gord broke into the thieves' camp, and soon the keeper of the place agreed to examine Gord's merchandise. Break. All right. It's interesting that Gord has immediately recognized a fence where he's going to be able to sell the gems he'd hoped to buy in the down quarter. So we have a little bit of description here of Radagast City and that, that there is a thieves' quarter, a low quarter, a slum quarter kind of thing. We don't know how much. It doesn't sound as bad as, the slum quarter and is more likely the Radagast City version of the down quarter. It was of the thieves' quarter. So, here's a little bit of description there for Radagast City.
Yeah, they give us a district at least.
And the thieves' camp is the same, or at least recognizable, and the signals in Radagast City as it is in the City of Greyhawk.
They say the previous day he saw something that he thought would be perfect, a place that he thought would be perfect. Maybe there was some symbol outside the door or...
That, that is, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, that is very likely that, it's probably a pawn shop or a little, a very good merchant and probably some hidden... or concealed symbol, or just something that is normally unrecognizable to anybody except Thieves Guild members, you know. And Gord's teaching had originally been by the Thieves Guild, so rather than just by somebody independently part of the Thieves, he had learned the actual Thieves' cants and symbology. All right, I'm going to restart. We're on page 118, and this is paragraph 4. The two retired toward a back room. Gord examined the entrance carefully before going in, and scrutinized the room itself even more thoroughly for secret doors or floor traps once he was inside, before settling down to the business at hand. All of this made the fence grin, for he appreciated professionalism in those he dealt with. They soon struck an agreeable price. Two of the man's assistants fetched his money box. He paid Gord, and that was that. Gord had been careful to have the fellow retain a tithe for the local guild. Whether he paid it or kept it was his business, but Gord would never be in trouble on that score. Guildmasters had a way of learning the truth, and they seldom used spells to gain such information. With a fresh half score of orbs, as well as assorted loose change to boot, Gord felt much better. Now he was solvent again. Time to get on with the rest of it. Whistling a merry tune, Gord went out the northernmost gate of the city, rather than the southeastern one which led to Mudditch. Just as darkness was fallen, he came upon a gypsy wagon, its driver lounging beside it. After a brief conversation, Gord clambered into the vehicle, and the driver clucked the team of horses into motion, and the wagon rolled along the road on its way to who knew where. Break. I think one of the things that interests me, if we look at the map that seemingly, and look at the Atonsme, even from the Darlene map, it would seem that it really should be a northwestern gate that leads to Mudditch, not a southeastern gate, which would put Mudditch, it would put, kind of put Artonsme on the other side, the Artonsme, Radagast City, on the other side of the Artonsme, and the area of Mudditch lower down. It just seems, it doesn't really seem to conform to what we're seeing on the maps. You know, it's definitely shows Radagast City in a hex that is south of Mudditch. And, you know, I find that a little strange. Gord, you know, we're seeing also here that Gord is able to get quite a bit of gold for those gems, and where he ends up with, you know, 10 orbs. Which, you know, it is gems. It's a whole box of gems. But it just seems like that is such a, you know, pretty large amount that, again, it makes it very unlikely, I think, that the gem merchant wouldn't have a door guard and that it could be robbed and, you know, only protected by probably a non-leveled sun. It seems like they would have some kind of guardsman in that shop. And that is, you know, that is a good idea, a good amount of gold there, you know, 10 gold pieces, to have gotten for those.
I think Gord said that wasn't even the shop that he wanted to go to, right? I mean,
yes.
Wasn't even the best shop.
Yes. It could be that goldsmith shop with the ruby earrings, was more, you know, was a higher, you know, more wealthy one. But if the value of the item's stolen, that he's getting a fence's amount, which is only a fraction of its value, would seem that there should be a easy way to have hired guardsmen to watch over the shop. You know, if that's the kind of value that the shop had at hand, just in like the open tabletop merchandise, then it really seems like there should have been, I found that encounter very, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to have been well thought out. And I found it a little out of character. So I don't know what we can say definitely about the development of Gord's character. That seems like a very radical switch in his character there, to just sacrifice Adez. He does, like you said, he mentions that it wasn't the shop he wanted, and he only ends up making, he gave Adez those earrings, which cost 2 gold. He's only getting a net gain of 8 gold, which is a fabulous amount. And it just seems that...
He could still buy another dagger, another magic dagger, and another set of earrings with 8 gold.
I know. And it seems... I think that here, maybe the idea of that gold value is it's a little shaky in the story at this point, that it's a little inconsistent. Now that we've moved up and no more talk about bronze bits and copper common, no, brass bits and bronze Z's and copper commons, now we've moved up into gold and platinum. It just seems like, it's much less defined in the value of the coins. So I'm not really sure. It seems like the magic dagger should have been much, much more. And, it really does strike me that it seems like a little inconsistent with the super high value of gold. But also, it does show that the gems themselves, just plain gems, should have a very high value in themselves. And I think that if he's getting 10 gold from a fence for what he's just stolen, then those gems and stones are worth quite a bit. Quite a bit, because I don't think he would just have, to the fence, it's only going to get a fraction of what the fence is going to get for it. So
I think the most you could expect to get, even from a fence that you knew, would be about 50%. So I would say more than 30.
Yeah, I think that one of the things you have to understand is that when you look at somebody paying for, especially illegally gotten goods, they're unlikely to pay you as much as they're expecting to get. So they're unlikely to pay you 1 gold if they're going to only make 2. They're only going to make as much as you made. There's going to be a big drop in value because they're buying stolen goods. Because otherwise, he could just sell them, hold it on, go to another city, and sell the gems for, just as non-stolen gems. Because how would they know that if he went back to Lukash, or if he goes up the river to Stoink, how would they know that the gems are stolen? So he could just go to a regular merchant. And it's the regular merchant, and even a regular merchant would be unlikely to pay 50%. Fence prices really have no bottom, I would think, whatever they can get away with. I can't see 50% for it.
Yeah, though. That's high.
And then that would mean that the merchant value of the gems would be, even at 50%, the merchant value would be then 20 golds worth, and more than likely 30 or 40 golds worth or more of gems. And again, that just says to me that they in this kind of setting, that even if you don't look at the individual power levels of thieves, then it would just be such a fortune that just being in a shop with a merchant and his son seems like too little protection. A little band could burst in and hold them at knife point or sword point, or kill them and tie them up and get out of there without being detected, the way that they seem to have that, jeweler's shop. It seems like there'd have to be some kind of professional guards guarding anything of great value. And I find that a little out of place in the story. I find Gord's, you know, complete cynicism there very out of place. Now, we do have, that Radagast City, however it's made up, also has, an established Thieves Guild. And you could kind of expect that anywhere. I don't think there's any mention that they're quite as out in the open as they are in the city of Greyhawk. But he does know enough to tithe for the local Thieves Guild. The last thing we have another mention. I don't really know where this place is, Mudditch, because that seems out of place. And there, outside of Radagast City, we find one of the Atloy. So they are also in Mudditch, but here they are in Radagast City. And it could be, it hasn't been mentioned, perhaps Radagast City doesn't allow Rene to camp within their borders, within the city walls. That would be an explanation of why they go to Mudditch and then go to Radagast City. Even though they're supposedly liked in Radagast City, it could be easily explained that they just simply, they can come in and do things, but I don't think there's any mention of Gord or the other Rene being allowed to stay overnight. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 119, paragraph 2. 1 week and 50 leagues later, Gord and his new acquaintances were camped in the rich grasslands of the Artansame River Valley. These Rene, or Atloy, according to the prejudiced view of the barge folk, were much the same as their lake-faring cousins, only a bit wilder and rougher. In fact, Gord would never have trusted such folks, save for the fact that he was an adopted Rene, knew their speech, and actually looked similar to these people. Besides, he had paid them well in gems, although of the smallest and least valuable sort, for their help in this scheme, and the subsequent conveyance of his person away from Radagast City. Gord was frankly happy to be away from the water, but he was sore and stiff. Riding a horse was no simple thing, and his lessons were painful. These wagon-born Rene were horse breeders, among other occupations, such as thievery, tinkering, and entertaining. This wilderness place was one of their grazing areas, and there were a hundred or so horses with the band. The full crop had been good, and all the animals were in splendid condition. They would be moved to the Great Northern Bend area in another week, and selected horses would be sold at the animal fair and horse market there. That was where Gord planned to leave the gypsy train and seek his fortune elsewhere. Break. All right, now we have Gord has broken away from the Rennie. We've moved into, the wider world of the Flaness here. And we have, talk of the Artansame River Valley and the Great Northern Bend area. And that the area seems to be pretty open if it is, the grassland for a large herd of horses. Here we have them with, 100 or so. We also have mentioned that Gord seems to have held back some gems because he's paying the Rene in them. There has to be, here we're looking at these Atloy, and Gord is on his own, and even though he's adopted cousin and knows the language of the Rene folk, it really speaks that they don't just rob him or attempt to rob him, rather than, because he is a complete stranger to them. So there has to be, even though Adez was very, acting very superior to the Atloy and very insulting to them, there has to be some kind of trust between them to allow somebody who's learned from the Rene barge folk to be able to cross peacefully with these Atloi. Also, we have again that they're horse breeders, these Atloi, that they're thieves, entertainers, and tinkerers. So we have them as very much the classic gypsy. We don't know anything else so far about their culture, and I would say it's just safe to assume that if you looked at, kind of modern or early 20th century views of gypsies in movies like, you know, The Wolfman, which I keep bringing up, that we can get a good look at probably the Atloi even more than what the René Barge folk are like. Because here they are, as in their gypsy wagon train, very similar to what they talk about, in modern or earthly, our earth history of the gypsies, or at least the popular conception of them. And also, finally, we have that Gord is learning to ride a horse. And, you know, that is one of the key things with background. If you're going to do a city background, then you really need to think, are the characters going to know how to ride a horse? I mean, because say you lived like Gord did in the city of Greyhawk, at some point when they talk about him traveling a mile or two outside the city walls, maybe he learned horse riding then, or maybe a character could. But certainly it's not going to be a very strong skill for somebody coming from a city background. And that little point, I think that is something that is kind of hand-waved or just not looked over in a lot of campaigns. But not every character is going to know how to ride a horse or row a boat or even swim. So, and if you're doing things like in a northern climb, knowing how to walk on snowshoes or skis, all of these are skills that really should be learned, and they can add, a little bit to a wilderness campaign where you want to see the characters developing things that are not all just combat related and washed over. You want to add a little depth to the game, so having characters learning to ride when they begin their game, that can be a little added something, add some humor or interest to your campaign. All right, I'm going to restart here. It's page 119, the final paragraph. Meanwhile, however, he practiced his riding, played at fencing with the exceptionally able swordsman of the group, and even learned the use of the crossbow. He had no intention of lugging around one of these small missile weapons favored by the wagon folk, but Gord decided it would be useful if he knew how to operate a crossbow in a tight situation, such as when the barge had nearly been wrecked by the monstrous creature from the depths of the near Dev. Well, that is interesting then, that the crossbow seems to be a René Atloi cultural weapon. That here we have both the Atloi and the René knowing how to use the crossbow. And I would say if you're going to run either one of them, you might want to do something like, say, that the non-leveled René have experience using crossbow and get a benefit from it, even though they may not be, you know, leveled warriors, or but that even, you know, that they should know how to use like cultural weapons to a degree, if they're not too if they're not too esoteric or complex. But knowing how to use a dagger, which seems to be one of their main weapons. Now here the Atloi, Gord mentions that there are able swordsmen among them, which seems to be a little different from the barge folk, that the Atloi are know how to and maybe are very used to using a sword from horseback, crossbow from their wagons. So it starts to paint a picture of the culture of both of them. And a lot of the Atloi culture are going to be follow the René culture. I think that it may be stressed that they started out as wagon, like normally gypsy on wagon, and then turned into the barge folk. But nothing mentioned here about that yet. But I find it very interesting. And then the idea that they're also entertainers, and that fits more in the kind of classical gypsy. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 120, first paragraph. The journey was unhurried, for they stopped at every village and hamlet to offer services, perform, trade, occasionally make off with some unguarded livestock or goods. Ward noted that these René were most prudent in exercising thievery. Since this was a route they regularly traveled, the gypsies were careful to give the inhabitants of their stopping places no reason to feel hostility toward them. They tinkered, traded sharply, sold questionable remedies, and stole only small things. That made them exciting and dark visitors, not threatening ones. When they sang, danced, told fortunes, juggled, made their trained animals perform, and otherwise entertained, a bit of dishonesty could be forgiven. Each rustic felt that it was his or her business to be on guard against minor pilfering and poultry theft when the wagon folk came. After all, they brought news, excitement, a virtual carnival with them each time they passed through an area. The fair was held outside the walled town of Caporna. At fair time, the town's 6,000 or so inhabitants served as a host for travelers from all around the place. For the duration of the month-long event, the population inside the walls was nearly twice normal, and thousands more camped outside the town. Ward and the gypsies arrived at the outskirts of Caporna some 3 weeks after they had left the vicinity of Radagast City. In a few days, the festival that opened the event would be underway, and everyone in the train was busy preparing for the upcoming demands. Having nothing of the like to concern himself with, Gord took the opportunity to improve his horsemanship while seeing a bit of the countryside. Right. Well, that Caporna, that sounds like a more of a small city at 6,000. You know, I believe that even Verbabank at the time is only 12 or 13,000. So I would say that Caporna is much more than a town. And it's walled. We learned that. So it's either a walled town or a walled city. It is supposedly just three leisurely, was it weeks? Or
3 weeks.
3 weeks travel from Radagast City. But again, they said it was a leisurely trip.
It's on that map I posted.
It is. I like seeing that. And if you notice the symbology.
Yeah, Dana's maps. I forget exactly what that means.
Yeah, the yellow circle with a dot at the center. I see some that are just a yellow circle, but many are a dot at the center. So I would say it's probably a small city. It's just that mentioned population is quite big. You know, I think you will even find breakdowns in some places of what various fantasy or even real world considerations of the different population of town to city. And just 6,000 seems, especially in the Flaness, it seems a pretty big amount for a town population. We have more about the preparation of the Atloy, what they do and what their entertainments are, and you know, explanations of why you know, that they are not as much thieves as tinkerers and entertainers and horse traders, and their reasons, because they're more locked into a set you know, a set path for their travels back and forth. It is strange, though, that same kind of thing should be true for the barge folk. But I would think the difference may be that, you know, going through small towns and thieving would leave a much bigger mark than going through a, a big city. So that it could be said that maybe the René do more thievery because they're coming across, you know, cities like Greyhawk and Radagast City and Lukesh, rather than smaller places like Caporna. And then finally, we have that Gord is again mentioned that he's practicing his horsemanship. So if I think that is something really to take away for the game, is to just say that the characters, they should keep mentioning, the players should keep mentioning that they're trying to increase their skills, so that down the road, you know, it'll be like, well, you know, you only learn to ride here and you never practice it. And I think it does behoove a DM to keep a little bit on top of players and to get the players used to filling in information, marking it down on their sheets, adding something to their character as it grows. I know I've heard that some DMs say, well, I don't want like 6 pages of background. But I used to love the DM logs that talked about what happened in the adventure. And I think that if you have a character that's growing from first level, that you should keep a kind of journal, an adventurer's journal, and that you really do, as I think it's very rewarding for a player to develop that kind of habit and develop that kind of thing which says, all right, well, from here to here, you know, I was practicing horsemanship, I learned how to swim, you know, and I've just, as the campaign goes by and weeks of time go by, you can say, all right, well, you've been now riding for 2-3 months and you're no longer a neophyte or anything, you've learned to become an acceptable horseman, not an expert or anything, but I really think that it does help the game if they do have a growing background, and it shows the past, you know, the development of the character, and it doesn't have to be much. You don't have to spend all your time in it, but I like that better than like just a straight combat game.
Yeah, I mean, that's not 6 pages. That's 2 lines. I mean, 1 for crossbow and 1 for horsemanship.
And I don't think you need a highly dramatized or detailed, kind of listing, but I think it's very good to have, some kind of shorthand. Now, I am not a DM who enjoys the skill system, per se, but I do like the idea that the skill systems, they do kind of tell you what the player needs to know and develop in their character. And so I think it can give everybody a good idea. And think about useful things like fletching arrows, repairing armor. They might learn a little blacksmithing. They might sit down with an experienced fletcher. Say your character doesn't normally use a disposable missile weapon, and wants to learn more about creating, you know, quarrels, and it doesn't have to lock it in, but it does give a little bit of depth, and I think that would be very worthwhile. And here Gygax shows, besides everything else going on, just in a few mentions, that here he is, and he is practicing his horsemanship. Now,
he's
finally, from
smart.
This,
he uses his time pretty well.
Yes, and Gygax does a benefit by adding that little tidbit to the story, and I think that is the one thing about the gameplay. You don't have to tell a story, but you should have important things or just regular things happening in the character's life, rather than just going to a dungeon and coming back to town to sell the stuff or buy things. I think there's a lot of character development that is very simple to do, and I really like seeing it written here in the story. The final thing is this major festival. Now, previously it was mentioned that it was going to be at the Great Northern Bend area. So it would be, this Capornia should be some marking that it is called the Great Northern Bend.
Yeah, I couldn't see that. And that's when he said he was thinking about leaving the Atloy.
Yes, and at this festival, and a huge festival, if you think about it, it's bringing in 6,000 people and 6,000 travelers coming to Caporna, which, That is quite a bit, especially as it is not off the Artansame. So they're going to have to follow various routes. And so, you know, that is, it's doubling the population within the walls of the city. So that festival is quite the big thing. And it should be something that is drawing people from throughout the region, you know, like from Radagast City and all the way around, to bring that many people. Because how many of these people are going to be traveling leagues beyond their homes? That was very uncommon. And and this is such a dangerous land that you can't really see it being casually done. You could see it as, you know, merchant caravans and the horse traders and stuff on the road coming to that Caporna. And then what strikes my mind is, why Caporna? What is in there that would attract this kind of festival? You'd have to think that it wouldn't be something that would be happening simultaneously in the other areas, because where would the people be coming from? You know, it could draw in local farmers and stuff, but it's unlikely that, I mean, the way it's depicted, it doesn't seem to be anything sizable, you know, within miles of Caporna. And that just strikes me that this should be, you know, pretty important little town or city, and that this should be a major kind of festival bringing in all that many strangers there. And a lot of, you know, campaign ideas, because, you know, boy, that really, that would attract all kinds of adventures and thievery and raids. There could be a tremendous amount, and you know, for low-level characters, work as guardsmen and, you know, to protect these caravans, both on their way and out. So there could be quite a bit of little adventuring ideas around this city of Caporna. I am going to restart, and we're on page 120, and it is paragraph number 4. Had pretty well covered the area around Caporna, and spent a goodly amount of time within the town proper as well, when he discovered another encampment of wagon folk. Their practice astounded the young man, for they were tumblers and acrobats. From the smallest child to the gray-bearded lord of the train, each and every one had some contribution to make to a breathtaking performance. After an awestruck gourd stood gawking at the rehearsal for a time, one of their number came up to him and suggested that gourd move on. Three shows were not a part of their offering, the man told gourd rather curtly, and he'd soon be able to view their wonders properly during the fair. Having dressed himself in clothing other than that worn by the René, gourd was not particularly recognizable as an adopted member of the folk, nor could anyone seeing him have guessed that he was a master beggar, or had at least been one once. Gourd conveyed his respect to the man in the patois of the wagon folk, and topped it off with the secret signs of both beggars and thieves. The muscular performer who had appeared to shoo away a non-paying spectator now served as his emissary to the leader of the group, and soon Gourd was being given warm greetings and cool wine. After bidding adieu to his traveling companions of the last few weeks, and paying a bit too much for the mount he had selected from them, Gourd shifted from one camp of gypsies to another. He was determined to learn more of the feats he had seen performed, although he had revealed himself as an adopted member of the barge folk. These René were quick enough drop their prejudices and accept Gourd. It did not hurt a bit that he had gifted the lord of the encampment with fine wine from Caporna. Gourd offered to teach the gypsy some of his skills in thievery in return for the instruction he would receive in the arts of acrobatics. There was little time for such interplay during the hustle and bustle of the fair. But when the festivities concluded at good month's commencement, Gourd would be taught and would himself instruct as the band moved on in its travels. break. All right. Again, we get some, you know, good information here about the Atloy, and not only that, they also have their animosity against the Rene, and it, you know, it seems to be a two-way street where even though they seem to be cousins of a sort, both groups are different enough to hold a kind of bigoted position against each other. Then we have this second group of Atloy, who are, you know, the tumbling acrobatic performers, where that seems to be a little more casual. And we hear about the other Atloy using their animals as part of their performance. So, you know, we can see that the various wagon folk are going to be, have, you know, like different kinds of skills. And mostly, a lot of their stuff just seems to be related to entertainment, where the Rene barge folk don't seem to have that, but they do talk about the women being sages and diviners. But these Atloy are much more in, like, you know, traveling carnival people in a way with these acts than the Rene would be. And I think that here you can add that to, like, their gypsiness, that they're also going to be like the, say, medieval style or, you know, early Renaissance carnival performers. And they were also known in the way that they're being described here as like also involved in thievery and stuff. And I think that if you want good background, that to look at some of the movies or books or more popular fiction than reality, I would say, on what those kind of people would be like. And I know I've seen various uses of that kind of medieval or Renaissance acrobatic performer or carnival kind of performer in, you know, recent TV and movies. So I think there's a lot of stuff that you can get to flesh out the Atloy, the Rene, but really, especially now the Atloy, I think it's to a greater amount. Now there's also mention here of when the fair is, that it ends at the beginning of Good Month. So we're given another thing in the time period that happens. Offhand, you know, I know that it's mentioned previously that the warm weather was beginning when Gord was at the Rene barge folks' winter quarters, and it was getting warmer. And now we have Gord, the time moving up to where the fair ends at the beginning of Good Month. So we have an idea of how much time has passed, and we also have an idea of when this fair is. I think that it's also interesting to note that the beggar signs and thief signs from the city of Greyhawk, they were familiar enough to these wagon-born Atloy all the way out here that they could understand it. But I guess it was also very helpful that Gord could speak in the language of the Atloy as well. And so we're looking, wow, that it's high summer, and that this season, this festival, seems to be during reaping. And if it ends at Good Month. The final thing that I thought interesting too here was that there is fine wine in Caporna. So Caporna is either a place where they're importing the wine, or the local areas might be one of the areas that wine is being grown. You know, I don't know what makes sense, or you know, as far as wine growing, but it is not Earth, and the weather and things don't have to be the same to match it up by, you know, longitude and latitude and stuff. So I think that just the mention that they have fine wine in Caporna, that adds a little bit to the campaign. And later on, you could mention that there's the Capornan wine at some inn. And it's nice to have little listings of things that flesh out the campaign when there should be some areas that have, you know, certain choices, so that you're not just drinking wine or drinking ale, that there's certain things, and it can add to the depth and character of the campaign. Well, we're running up to 7 o'clock, and I'm going to stop here on page 121 and take up from there at recording number 17. At this point, you can find the archives of recordings 1 to 15 up on the Cannon Fire website. Well, that's going to be it for me. See ya.
All right, good night.
Good night.